So how's the winter looking? We know it'll be cold and there will be snow. How cold and how much snow? It could depend on a weather phenomena in the Pacific Ocean. More in just a moment. This is Jet Streaming, the podcast devoted to the weather and climatology and heard around the world, produced by Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Kathy Werzer, along with meteorologists Paul Huttner and Dr. Mark Seely from the University of Minnesota, who's also a climatologist. Hi, guys. How are you?
Great, Kathy.
Good
how are
morning.
You today?
Doing fine.
You always are doing fine. I'm glad you guys joined us. Thanks. Well, we've heard of El Nino, and the feminine counterpart, I suppose you can say, is La Nina, and we could get a taste of what she can dish up this winter. Joining us from NOAA's Climate Prediction Center is the Acting Deputy Director of the CPC, Mike Alpert. Hello, Mike.
How you doing?
All right, so far. Thanks for joining us.
You're very welcome.
Let's begin with some definitions. What exactly is La Nina?
La Nina is when the ocean temperatures across or throughout the equatorial Pacific become colder than average, as opposed to the El Nino phenomenon when those waters become warmer than average.
And the effects generally, if you have a La Nina, are?
They're somewhat opposite to El Nino. They're also variable over North America. Obviously, we're concerned more with Minnesota, but I'll look at the country as a whole. Typically with La Nina, we see warmth across the southern half of the nation, or at least warmer than average winters. We see drier than average conditions also across the south. The north is a little trickier. We've seen with the weaker cases, sometimes in particular in the late winter, we see colder than average conditions, not so much at least in our fairly limited sample, warmer than average. But the cold is more a late winter, early on in the winter, it's kind of a mixed bag. Precip-wise, we generally see it wet in the Pacific Northwest as well as in the Ohio Valley, not a real strong signal up in the Minnesota region with regards to rainfall or snowfall.
Mike, Mark Seely here. I wondered, many from the research community have talked about this notion that El Nino and La Nina are not perfect contrasts of each other because when La Nina episodes occur, they do not tend to show the same spatial scale or amplitude as El Nino conditions. Can you explain your perspective on that a little bit?
Sure, although before I do, let me make sure I understand the question. When you're talking about spatial scales, are you talking about the downstream atmospheric effects or just the ocean changes with regards to ocean temperatures?
The research I'm referring to talks about the spatial scale of the ocean anomaly.
Okay. The way both El Nino and La Nina work is when we see these changes in ocean temperatures, the real impact and the reason why we care and have effects over North America is it changes the distribution of tropical rainfall. With an El Nino case, we typically extend the tropical rainfall further to the east, and that then links up through into the atmosphere and extends the Pacific jet stream further across the Pacific Ocean. La Nina works the opposite way, and we see that the tropical rainfall ends up to be shifted westward. And when that happens, the jet across the Pacific retracts westward. And so you end up with, instead of this very persistent jet across the Pacific, in the case of El Nino, you end up with one with the jet exit region is somewhere over the central Pacific, and allows a lot more variability downstream. What we've seen in particular in the weaker cases, we see a more predominance of blocking episodes at high latitudes. And the blocking episodes over maybe in the Gulf of Alaska or even over Alaska are oftentimes the cases where we see the cold air mass intrusions into the northern part of the U.S. When we see the stronger La Nina cases, oftentimes what happens is the whole Pacific jet shifts northward, and that's where we end up with the warmth across the south and the drier conditions across the south. But oftentimes if the jet shifts far enough north, we don't even see the cold get into the northern part of the nation either. So it's not certainly a linear opposite to El Nino. El Nino is a more persistent pattern with regards to the jet. We don't see any blocking typically, so we see very few cold air masses make their way into the country. La Nina, we typically see more variability throughout a La Nina-type winter than we would during an El Nino winter.
And Mike, given this amplified variability that is associated with La Nina episodes, is it too early to say what the strength of this La Nina episode that's been discussed in recent weeks, what the strength of that will be? Is it too early to tell?
You know, it probably is. This is a La Nina event that we kind of have expected to have arrived much sooner, at least according to some of our very sophisticated models. So we're kind of behind the curve on this, or maybe we were ahead of the curve if you look at it at a different way. Over the past month, we've seen this increased development, and the question now for us here is where does it go from here? Does it kind of just stay in the weak range, in which case we're liable to see some decent cold air outbreaks into the northern part of the country and more blocking, or does it intensify as we go forward? Right now, it doesn't appear that this should become a very strong event, and it's liable to stay in the weak range, but that's something I wouldn't want to bet on at this time.
Mike, Paul Huttner here. I do a lot of the forecasting for Minnesota Public Radio. That means I deal with downstream atmospheric effects on a daily basis. That's kind of my business. I was looking back here for the Twin Cities. 9 years in a row, our average annual temperature in the Twin Cities has been above average if you look at the 116-year average here. And our last winter to be near or below average in terms of temperatures was 2000-2001 for at least two of the 3 months that we call meteorological winter. Mm-hmm. When CPC looks at a La Nina, for example, and calculates these seasonal outlooks and statistical trends, how do you factor in the overall backdrop of what appears to be a climate change signal and the backdrop of warming, this warm decade we've had, versus a seasonal or perhaps a 1 or 2 year event like a La Nina?
That is the tricky part of this forecast. The southern part of the nation will be a fairly easy part of the forecast since both the trends and La Nina favor the same sign. In the northern part of the nation, you're right, we've seen, and really the trends during the winter have been strongest over the U.S., right centered in the Minnesota area. That's been, if we want to call a forecast easy, that's been the easy one for us in the winters. For whatever reason, it's just been, it's easy to just forecast above normal. Given the increased variability that we're likely to see with La Nina, especially if this event stays weak, it's something that we're going to have to resolve. If you're familiar with our forecasts, then you would know that we do have the option on our forecasts to make a forecast. We call it equal chances, which is pretty much means that we can't resolve it. We don't know whether the effects that we would typically see with La Nina, how that compares or how that will weigh against these long-term trends. And an equal chance forecast basically means it could go either way.
You're riding the fence then, Mike.
you're right. Pretty much we are. It's a very unusual forecast for the Weather Service to make. In a way, it gives us the option to just say we really don't know. And we find that that's better than just guessing, first with regards to our own verification, but also with regards to what we're trying to – the message we're trying to impart to our customers, which is – you know, we're honest with you. I mean, this is a difficult forecast, and sometimes we just will say we just don't know, and we say we don't know a lot more with precip forecasts than we do with temperature. But the winter, the upcoming winter in the northern plains and into the northern and in the upper Midwest is going to be a very tricky forecast to make.
You know, Mike, this is going to be a question from a layperson. What are the elements that go into whether a La Nina stays weak or strengthens?
Well, a lot of it has to do with how well it couples to the atmosphere. One of the important ingredients that goes into the development of a La Nina or an El Nino or the low-level wind field across the equatorial Pacific. And if the ocean temperatures are cold enough and we see the shifts in convection, we're liable to see the winds do what we need them to do, and things might become stronger. The other factor that oftentimes goes into it is the subsurface ocean temperatures. Right now, the important thing with regards to tropical rainfall is the sea surface temperatures right at the surface. But what the down, the underneath that, down to 300 meters, will oftentimes give us a clue and help to determine whether or not this event will strengthen. At this time, the subsurface isn't really conducive for a real strong event. But again, as we go forward, that could change. But then that's why right now, if I had to be put on the spot, I would say we expect this to remain a weak event. But it doesn't take more than 2 to 4 weeks probably to change that whole subsurface ocean structure to one that could support a stronger event. Like I said, as we sit here in the middle of September, my own gut feeling is this will remain a weak event, but things can change more rapidly than we would expect sometimes.
Mike, I'll temper what I'm about to say by acknowledging on my visits to the CPC, I've visited there twice in the last decade, I admire the way you handle the pressure from the public regarding some of these expectations, but I can't help but note in the last few weeks, NOAA News has acknowledged that the balance of the North Atlantic hurricane season is expected to be active, partially factoring or weighted to a La Nina, a weak La Nina. Yet in your seasonal outlooks, at least for Western Great Lakes region where we reside, the last two have strongly favored both a warm autumn and a warm winter. I'm wondering, with the next seasonal release due out next week, might La Nina come into play in the seasonal outlook product of CPC?
Well, I could say without a doubt, since I'm the lead forecaster on this upcoming forecast, that La Nina will certainly play a role and a strong role in my thinking and all of the folks here. The whole process will begin this Friday. We have a conference call where we bring in some of our partners, and I'm sure we'll spend at least the first 15 to 20 minutes discussing La Nina, where we expect it to go, and how we expect it to impact the forecast. So yes, certainly La Nina will play a strong role in this upcoming forecast.
And we will then, when we see that forecast, we'll know who helped put it together.
Yes, my name will be on this one.
All right. Mike, thanks so much for joining us.
Okay, you're very welcome.
That is Michael Halpert. He's the Acting Deputy Director for NOAA's Climate Prediction Center.
Well, hurricane. I want to blow into town just like you do.
The cleanup continues after Hurricane Felix, a Category 5 storm that slammed into Nicaragua and the Honduras recently. It's estimated that some 300 families remain trapped in the mountains of Nicaragua after the storm made landfall. And Paul and Mark, boy, Felix was notable for a number of different reasons.
Well, one of the things was the rapid intensification. I mean, this thing went from a tropical storm to a Category 5 hurricane in 51 hours. I believe that is the most rapid intensification that they've documented of any storm on Earth ever recorded.
That's what I've heard, too, and rather scary when in the context of our hurricane forecasting to see something intensify that rapidly, Paul. That really is very problematic for the Hurricane Center to deal with.
And there are some critics of the forecast used to predict the strength of that storm, and there was an interesting article about that in National Geographic Online recently.
And, yeah, one of those was Dr. Keith Blackwell, and he's an associate professor of meteorology at the Coastal Weather Research Center, the Department of Earth Sciences at the University of South Alabama in Mobile, and he's a hurricane researcher. Keith, welcome to Jet Streaming.
Very much.
We saw Felix, a very amazing storm. And in general, when we talk about hurricane models and forecasts, what is typically most accurate? Is it the track or the intensity?
Well, the track is definitely something we've been able to improve in predicting quite substantially over the last 25, 30 years. The intensity is still a very, very difficult thing to get a handle on, and we've only shown limited improvement in intensity forecasts.
You know, it sounds, this is Kathy Werzer, by the way, Keith, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
It sounds as if the initial small size, as it were, of Felix kind of fooled the models.
Yes, I think so. from what I can, having forecast that storm for several, well, throughout its life, I can tell you that initially the northern Caribbean, the northeastern Caribbean, was not going to be very conducive for that storm to develop. And yet there was a small corridor in the southeast Caribbean that, if the storm moved into that area, would likely support, you know, significant intensification. And the small size of the storm, I think, was a factor in the models not being able to resolve the development of this storm, but also the fact that I think some of the models were, too many of them, were taking the storm a little further north than where it actually ended up, in other words, into the northeastern Caribbean, and into stronger wind shear conditions. And instead, the storm snuck into the southeast Caribbean and actually developed, and quite substantially. And the National Hurricane Center, you know, picked up on that. They were overriding the dynamical model guidance, and they were, you know, stating that the models are not doing much with this particular storm, but we see a very good environment ahead for this storm to develop. So, you know, again, it shows that it's very important to have a human in the loop, because your models are just crunching numbers. And, you know, this was a case in point that, you know, people really made a significant improvement on the forecast for the development of Felix over what the dynamical models were doing.
Mark Seeley here. I just wanted to ask, it's my perception that in the forecasting aspects of hurricanes, particularly when it comes to their intensity, that one of the tools deployed that's absolutely critical are the flights into the storm itself, and the frequency of those flights, because oftentimes it's data from those flights that validates a change in the forecast intensity. Is that a tool that on occasion should be deployed with higher frequency than normal?
My answer is yes. The more planes we can get into the storm, the better off we are. And the problem is that it's very expensive to do so. And but we get data from these reconnaissance aircraft that are just invaluable with telling us what the structure of the storm is and what the true intensity of the storm is down at the surface. Because for many, many years, even reconnaissance aircraft flying into storms, I think they started, what, back in the 1950s, routinely flying into storms. We found that the storms, the winds up at flight level, you know, indicated a certain strength of storm. But it wasn't until GPS drop zones were invented back in 1997, first deployed, I think, in 1997, 1998, that we actually got to see what the winds down near the surface were doing with these storms. And the GPS drop zones have revolutionized our ability to determine the true intensity of these hurricanes. And that's why, for instance, Felix, I mean, you know, let's face it, I mean, this year we've had the first season where we've had two Category 5 hurricanes making landfall at Category 5 intensity. Well, if using the old rules before GPS drop zones back in the late 90s, using the rules before then for identifying the intensity of the storm based on primarily on central pressure, we would not have upgraded Felix to a Cat 5 most likely when it hit Nicaragua. And but the drop zones, GPS drop zones, were showing that it was a Cat 5. But we didn't have that ability. And if you remember when Hurricane Andrew hit southeast Florida back in 1992, originally, you know, for 10 years, it was called a Category 4 hurricane. And then 10 years after the fact, they upgraded the storm to a Category 5, because we now know that a hurricane is really strong. You know, a well-developed hurricane has really strong winds near the ground, even stronger than are at flight level, where reconnaissance aircraft have been flying around for, you know, for decades. And so our understanding of these storms, how strong they are near the surface, has really been revolutionized.
You know, you were talking about more eyes out there to bring back valuable data for forecasters, but I'm wondering, how can the models be tweaked, if they can be, to provide more info on some of these smaller storms for more accurate forecasts?
Well, models, you know, the dynamical models have come a long, long way. And the tweaking is ongoing. You know, there's continual improvement with these models. And so it's an interesting problem to go in and actually figure out why the models almost by name missed the storm development, missed the Felix development in the Eastern Caribbean. But in general, the models do a fairly good job of capturing, you know, the development of tropical cyclones. And I would say that, you know, a model, if you've got a relatively dry environment out in the mid troposphere, the middle part of the atmosphere that hurricanes develop in, if you have a relatively dry environment and a small storm tries to organize in that type of environment, I think that the models can't resolve small storms very well at all. And I think the models are going to try and suppress a small storm development in a relatively dry mid-tropospheric environment because they think that the environment is hostile, essentially that the hurricanes need a moist environment. And yet, if the storm does find a favorable region, like what happened with Felix, a local region where things were favorable, the storm really, really developed quickly and then began to modify its environment, began to moisten the environment around it, and then all the way it went. And then the models eventually picked up on it and said, oh, yeah, there is something here after all.
Keith, like myself and all of us, I'm sure you see that hurricanes as some of those fascinating storms on Earth. I'm wondering, do you see in all your years of watching these storms, are any regular cyclical patterns to the fluctuations in intensity in a single storm? We hear about the eyewall replacement cycle, or is that intensity more driven by environmental factors like sea surface temperatures and the upper level wind profile?
Well, it's driven by all three things, but you know, you can have a very favorable atmospheric environment. You can have a very favorable sea surface temperature environment that a storm will be bathed in for the next several days, and you'll still get massive oscillations in strength in the hurricane due to internal dynamical processes going on within the core of the storm itself. And much of that is due to eyewall replacement cycles. For instance, Katrina in 2005, when it was in the central Gulf of Mexico, it had one eyewall. And then when it moved up into the, and it was very intense, and when it moved up into the north central Gulf, it developed two eyewalls and actually hit the coast with two eyewalls. I just presented a paper about 6 months ago at a hurricane conference on that, and since then there have been some peer-reviewed articles that have been put out in the Bulletin of American Meteorological Society and all showing that Katrina had two eyewalls at landfall on the northern Gulf Coast. And that's one reason why the storm weakened from a Category 5 with one eyewall, the central Gulf, to a Category 3 at landfall on the northern Gulf Coast. But, you know, and that's that number, you know, it weakened from a 5 to a 3. That means that the impact is going to be as great. No, that wasn't it at all. The storm grew immensely in size before it hit because it developed this outer eyewall. So it spread its destruction over a much larger area. And this outer eyewall was a very significant key in the ultimate impact that Katrina had on the northern Gulf Coast. And yet, if you look just strictly at the Saffir-Simpson scale, you say, oh, well, the storm's weakening. You know, we don't have that much to worry about. It's only going to be a 3 instead of a 5 here. You know, we've lived through several 3s down here, and they're bad, but they're not cataclysmic. But this one actually had the energy of a 5. It was just disguising itself as a 3. Hmm. And that was one of its secrets.
Final quick question here for you. What might be in store for the remainder of the hurricane season from where you sit?
Well, I would have thought we'd had more storms by now, to tell you the truth. But we have had two very intense storms and in the deep tropics. And, the prediction for African rainfall, which is where many of these tropical waves originate that generate, you know, eventually generate hurricanes, is for above normal rainfall to persist in equatorial Africa. That should generate some pretty hefty tropical waves. But the thing that is kind of interesting is the sea surface temperatures off the west coast of Africa are actually running a little below normal now. And so that might be putting a little bit of a lid on the activity that's possible this year. But otherwise, because we have, I know your previous guest there was talking about the La Nina in the Pacific going on now, that's usually very conducive for Atlantic hurricanes. And so conditions overall are very favorable for hurricanes in the Atlantic this year. It looks like they're just having trouble getting started to some degree, and it might be due to that lower water temperature off the coast of Africa that I just mentioned.
Yeah, we'll see what happens. Dr. Blackwell, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Enjoyed talking with you.
Likewise. That was Dr. Keith Blackwell from the Coastal Weather Research Center in Mobile, Alabama. Good conversation there. Well, earlier on the cast, we talked with Mike Halpert from the Climate Prediction Center about this winter's potential influence of La Nina, as you just heard. And we have this listener question, my goodness, that dovetails nicely with that conversation. I shall throw the question the way of Dr. Seeley. And this listener asks, or says, I should say, I've heard atmospheric scientists refer to El Nino and its counterpart La Nina as climate teleconnections because their associated patterns in equatorial sea surface temperature and barometric pressure. What are some of the other teleconnections being studied and used by atmospheric scientists?
Well, there are very many, Kathy, that are used commonly by the world's weather services for mid and high latitude positions and assessing the seasonal outlooks and weather patterns. There's the Pacific North American teleconnection, the Arctic Oscillation, the Antarctic Oscillation, the North Atlantic Oscillation, and the Pacific Decadal Oscillation. Now, all of those take the form of sea surface temperature anomalies or barometric pressure anomalies. In the subtropical and tropical positions for climate assessment and outlooks, they use the Madden-Julian Oscillation, which is based on infrared radiation and convective activity, mm-hmm. and the Indian Dipole, which is also another phenomena in the Indian Ocean Basin. One that's come into play recently and was actually in the news in recent weeks, in addition to doing the North American seasonal outlook next week, factoring in the La Nina, mm-hmm. the equatorial Pacific, and its strength, another feature they're going to use that's a teleconnection is called the October Siberian snow cover.
Now, that's a good one.
Now, believe it or not, the amount and extent of snow cover in Siberia during the month of October actually has something to say about what the North American winter might be like. So that's why they track it.
Lovely. See, I knew you'd know all this.
and interesting topic, too, because in talking to Mike from CPC, that, you know, is this backdrop of climate change the meteorological or the climate trump card for all of these oscillations? Does it override them? And I think that's something that they're wrestling with as we see a decade long of temperatures that seem to exceed maybe some of the signals of these oscillations that we're seeing. I know PDO, Pacific Decadal Oscillation, has been linked to mega drought or a 10-year longer drought in the southwestern United States. So these things matter, and the real trick for these folks is to figure out how do you weigh each one of these teleconnections that we're seeing.
Absolutely. Good point, Paul. That teasing out those details is a formidable challenge.
It's on to our weather website of the week. Yes, there's the thunder. It's my turn. It's the website for NOAA's Environmental Visualization Program. Have you seen this, by the way? This is interesting satellite imagery for major storms each year. This year, you can see the sat images of Hurricane Felix and Hurricane Dean, among others. Check it out. Here it is, www.nnvl.noaa.gov. Ha-ha. You'll like that when you see it, you geeks.
I love
Seriously.
It. Seriously. Already.
We have covered a lot of ground, gentlemen. Thank you.
Great show. Interesting guests and very timely discussions today.
Absolutely.
Yeah, we'll keep our fingers crossed that we can get a handle on what this winter might be like.
Well, next week, you know, who knows what we're going to do next week. That's the great thing about the weather. Wait a while and it changes, and that's how we approach Jet Streaming, a podcast about the weather and climatology produced by Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Kathy Werzer. Don't forget we love interaction with Jet Streaming users. Drop us a line by going to minnesotapublicradio.org or address the email to weather@minnesotapublicradio.org. Until next week, remember to keep your eyes on the sky.